And we'll go on then to the next case of the day, which is State versus Nicholas J. Ely. And Justice Friedman is recused from this matter. Mr. Munley, are you here?
I am, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you very much. And Ms. Faust, are you here?
Yes, I'm here, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Munley, good morning to you, and you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. My name is Brian Munley. I represent Nicholas Ely. Mr. Ely was convicted following a jury trial of first degree felony murder and use of a firearm to commit a felony. He was represented by the same attorneys on appeal that had been appointed to him at the time of trial. His convictions and sentences and sentence was affirmed by this court in 2014. Although he had twice requested to proceed pro se prior to trial, the requests were denied by the district court. Additionally, Mr. Ely filed a motion to dismiss appellate counsel and appoint a new appellate counsel after his appeal had been perfected. As this court knows, a defendant in a state criminal trial has a right under the 6th and 14th Amendments to proceed without counsel and under the Nebraska Constitution, Article 1, Section 11. A criminal defendant has the right to waive the assistance of counsel and conduct his or her own defense. And if
Mr. Munley, that wasn't the request that he made with respect to the appellate counsel, was it? He still wanted counsel. He just wanted different counsel.
Well, his appellate. Yeah, I think Mr. Ely became educated as this case progressed. You're right. He did ask for a counsel to represent him in his direct appeal.
What have we said about requests for change of counsel? They're not automatic.
It's not automatic, but Your Honor, this issue goes to the beginning. His initial request, August 21st, which he made it clear that he wanted to represent himself. He puts that in the motion. He also puts in his motion August 21st that he wants appointed counsel to help him for an advisory role when he has questions. That was the hearing that there was a litany between the judge and the defendant at that point. It was denied.
A trial judge doesn't have to allow this sort of hybrid split relationship. That the judge can insist, and I would suggest should insist, that either the defendant is going to represent himself or he's going to be represented by counsel. Because if you have a hybrid relationship, how do you decide who's responsible for what?
I agree, Your Honor, and that's been decided throughout the ages, the hybrid type of relationship. But I think what is at issue here is the protected autonomy right that Mr. Ely has to allow him to control his trial, and it's a special right that was completely denied.
Did he ever file a motion or make a request that he just wanted to do it himself without any reference to assistance of standby counsel?
Well, I don't think that appears in a motion. I don't think it appears in a motion, but you've got his deposition, Your Honor. And I would refer to the deposition of Mr. Ely, page 10, line 13 through page 11, through page 12, line 7. That explains exactly what was going through his mind. He's asked if he ever asked his attorneys about his right to represent himself. He says, I didn't ask them about it. I actually learned about it. I read a book saying that the only option you have if you're not paying for your counsel, the only option you have if you're not satisfied with your counsel is to dismiss them and represent yourself. And at that time, I had a little bit iffy about it, but she was lying to me and so forth and so on. He goes on to explain, Your Honor, exactly what he was thinking. He did not want to be represented by this counsel. He wanted to represent himself. And he makes it clear from the beginning of his efforts till the case is on appeal. And as you said, he doesn't ask for right to represent himself on the appeal. But I think perhaps by then he had realized that that's not a right that he has, but he certainly was not happy with this same counsel that represented him at trial. And that's what's in the motion that he files while the case is on appeal. He says,
What did he ask? What did the motion filed on August 21st, that was several weeks before trial, what did he request in that motion?
He requested appointment of new counsel, then he puts in parentheses, myself, pro se, by the court, would assure the defendant a fair trial. And again, I get back to that autonomy right that he has.
And is it your position that in that motion, he made an unequivocal assertion that he wished to represent himself?
I think he does, and I think what he does as an alternative, he puts it in number six, which is the next one, which says, may I please have counsel appointed for me for help, advisory when I have questions. So I think he's asking primarily to represent himself, and I think he understands that he may have questions. And so I agree that the proper thing would have been to let him represent himself and appoint counsel.
What was the reason that the district court gave for denying that motion?
The reason was simply that he didn't think Mr. Ely could handle representing himself.
What did his defense counsel testify to in regard to this issue?
His defense counsel testified that, it's interesting, first of all, defense counsel said about the relationship with Mr. Ely, so would it be fair to say you received these motions, you obviously took them seriously, but would it be fair to say you didn't think that he truly wanted to represent himself? Answer, correct. After the first one, we met with him. I thought it was resolved. He didn't say to me, you're out, the next day. He then files it again. I was surprised right before trial. Coffee says, he says, judge says what he says to Nick, to his decision, but Nick never approached me again about it, or never approached me again. And that's, I addressed the issue of whether there was a waiver in the reply brief extensively, dealing with, I cite to Orozco versus Duggar, but there's numerous other state cases that I cite to for the proposition that a person's request to represent himself, once it's denied, he doesn't have to continue to make this request. I'm reading from the Orozco case. Petitioner's request to represent himself was denied. By failing to repeat his desire to represent himself, petitioner did not vacillate on the issue. He did not abandon his initial request. Orozco acquiescence in being represented by counsel because his request to defend himself had already been denied. To avoid a waiver of a previously invoked right to self-representation, a defendant is not required to continually renew a a request, once it is conclusively denied, or to make fruitless motions, or to forego cooperation with defense counsel in order to reserve his right for appeal. So I'd also submit,
Mr. Munnelly, if Mr. Ely's defense counsel believed, based on conversations with him, that he did not actually want to represent himself, would it be deficient performance for her to not to raise that on direct appeal?
Absolutely. Your Honor, there's a very good chance, I'd say it would be probable that if new appellate counsel was appointed, new appellate counsel would have raised this issue, especially in light of the pro se filings. I think the court has to look at this case as to whether appellate counsel acted ineffectively by not raising this issue, regardless of whether it was requested or not. It's obvious Mr. Ely had problems with the appeal process. As I said, he states in his motion to dismiss appellate counsel that counsel doesn't answer phone calls. He's not seen a full bill of exceptions.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but you really didn't answer my question. My question is not if there was new counsel on direct appeal. I'm talking about this case where it was the same counsel. And my question is that if she believed that he did not actually want to represent himself, would it be deficient performance for her to fail to make a Feretta argument on direct appeal?
I don't believe it. I don't think the issue as to his intent, it's because of this special type of, I mean, he makes a very clear request. So to answer your question, I would say no, because I don't think it's unequivocal at the beginning. And if it's not unequivocal, then the issue doesn't go away. This should have been brought up and discussed as to a viable issue. This should have been brought up prior to trial, in my opinion, but and discussed, and Feretta should have been looked at, and a resolution to this should have come out of some type of discussions about this. I would say that appellate counsel has a duty, as I say throughout the brief, to raise any issue, particularly that has merit, particularly that has such significance, and particularly that would have resulted in a reversal. So the answer is yes, appellate counsel would still have a duty to raise it.
Thank you very much. I believe we've used your time, Mr. Munnelly, so thank you. Ms. Faust, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stacey Faust. I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the appellee, the state of Nebraska. This court reversed and remanded this case for an evidentiary hearing on two of Eli's post-conviction, and I'm going to call him Eli because I have the entire time, so I apologize. Reverse remanded on two of Eli's post-conviction claims. One, ineffective assistance of trial counsel for failing to advise him of his right to testify. And two, ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for failing to argue in direct appeal that the district court erred in denying Eli the right to represent himself at trial. I think with regard to Eli's right to testify claim, he clearly loses. The district court correctly denied him relief on that claim because the court clearly believed his testimony on that issue, that his claim that she did not talk to him about testifying was a bogus statement. They did talk about it, and he chose not to testify because of his lengthy criminal history. I think the more complicated issue, as you spoke with counsel about, is his second claim with regard to Ms. Graves' failure to raise on direct appeal that the district court denied Eli his right to represent himself at trial. He has had the constitutional right to represent himself at trial. He had to assert that right timely, clearly, and unequivocally. And frankly, that's why I understood this court to grant him an evidentiary hearing in the last appeal. And I think that he did those three things in his August 21st motion. And I think it was made just as clear at the hearing following that motion, the district court and surely the prosecutor understood that he wanted to represent himself at trial. And that's what the district court essentially found in its post-conviction order denying Mr. Eli post-conviction relief. But the court concluded that this issue would not have been successful if raised on direct appeal because, and I'm summarizing, Eli didn't clearly ask to represent himself again after his August 21st motion, and because trial counsel did not know that he was unhappy with her after the hearing on that motion. And the court also noted that Eli may have waived the issue by not reasserting his request to represent himself. As I stated in brief, I disagree with the district court. I think that there is a reasonable probability that the issue would have been successful if raised on direct appeal because he did assert his right in his August 21st motion. It is structural error. I researched the waiver issue. I think Mr. Munnelly is correct. The main case that I found on that is a Fifth Circuit case, Brown versus Wainwright. And that case, I think with the other circuit cases that cite to it, stand for that once a defendant requests to represent himself and that request is denied, he doesn't have to keep reasserting it and he doesn't acquiesce by cooperating with his counsel on his defense. I think to abandon the request, he or his counsel in his presence will need to make some affirmative representations that he still wants counsel to represent him. They're all good. The relationship is good. So is there a reasonable probability that the outcome of the proceeding would have been different if Ms. Graiba would have raised this issue on direct appeal? I believe the answer is yes. Do I believe that her performance was deficient for failing to raise the issue on direct appeal? And I think the answer is no. And I realize that may sound strange, but I think what we have to remember is that we can analyze the prejudice prong for this issue from the cold trial record. We can't do that with deficient performance. Graiba's conversations with Eli are important to the deficient performance analysis, and we now have those conversations as part of the evidentiary hearing record in this case. Ms. Graiba testified that she and co-counsel, Mr. Stoller, met with Eli after he filed his August 21st motion. She thought their meeting resolved his motion, and he understood that representing himself was not in his best interest. He never brought up the issue with her again. And as a result, yeah, she didn't think about raising the issue on direct appeal, but she also didn't think that he truly wanted to represent himself. And I think this is corroborated by her testimony that Mr. Eli is a very difficult client. In other words, if he truly was not happy with her, he would have made that known to her. My position is that Graiba was not deficient for failing to raise this issue on appeal because her behind-the-scenes interactions, her conversations, his conduct with Mr. Eli led her to think that he did not want to represent himself. And I do not think that...
Sorry, counsel, would you agree that the argument you're making is not a basis upon which Judge Coffey denied post-conviction relief?
Yes, I agree, but it's a question of law.
Well, my follow-up question would be, aren't there, you're relying on Ms. Graiba's testimony about conversations she had with Mr. Ely, where she testified that she thought, based on those conversations, he didn't want to represent himself. But isn't there conflicting testimony from Mr. Eli, that this was never talked about?
True. She is taking from him. I think that their testimonies actually are one and the same. Because Mr. Eli says, no, I never talked to her about it. And she testifies, he never complained to me about my representation. He never complained that he didn't want me on the case. He never complained to me that he wanted to represent himself. So I think that they're actually saying the same thing.
If they're not saying the same thing, and she's saying, well, based on the conversations I had with him, I understood that he knew that he shouldn't represent himself or didn't want to represent himself. Can we resolve that conflict in the testimony, or is that something that needs to be done by the trial court?
Yes, it needs to be done by the trial court. And I think, although he didn't, the court did not resolve the issue of law, as I'm arguing, the court did make facts, make the following facts that, and that I think this worked into his, the court's analysis of why it wouldn't have been successful on appeal, that trial counsel testified about, pull this up here. Trial counsel also stated in her deposition that at no time after a hearing on the motion to dismiss counsel did the defendant make a request for her to remove herself from the case. And after his conviction, the defendant did not suggest or ask for counsel to raise the issue of representing himself on the direct appeal. Furthermore, he was supplied with an appellate brief and once again never mentioned the lack of self-representation as being an issue. So I think implicit in those findings are that she understood that he was happy with her representation of him.
But you're not contending. I thought earlier that you conceded that the district court did not deny the motion based on the absence of deficient performance. The district court denied the motion based on prejudice, the absence of prejudice.
That is correct. But I think that you can use those findings from the court to support the question of law on deficient performance.
Is this one of the small area of cases where prejudice should or should be presumed to the extent it is touching on a constitutional right?
No, Your Honor. No, Strickland applies in this situation. It's definitely not a chronic situation. He was represented at all stages and sufficiently so. It is structural error, but it is trial error, and appellate counsel's performance didn't cause a structural trial error. And although not on all fours, Weaver versus Massachusetts applied to the ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim for a structural error, the Strickland analysis. And I see no reason to extend that to an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel.
So you're combining the application of structural error and what's the second thing?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
You're saying it's structural error but not prejudicial?
I'm saying structural error, no deficient performance.
No deficient performance.
Yes.
I beg your pardon. Thank you.
Is it fair to say you've conceded that it was prejudicial? There is a reasonable probability the result would have been different if raised on direct appeal?
Yes.
Thank you.
There are no further questions. We ask you from the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Ms. Faust. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. So that concludes arguments for the day. This court is adjourned, and you are excused, those of you who participated. And again, thank you very much.